You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hello and welcome to the Critics Table. Every episode we are joined by three luminary theater critics as they review the latest shows on and off Broadway. You may agree with one, all of them, or none at all, but we ask that you listen first and ask questions later. Let's join the table, shall we?
Hello, I'm Juan Michael Porter II.
I'm Christian Lewis.
And I am Vidhatri D. Chaudhary.
And this is the Critics Table, where we discuss the hottest shows on and off Broadway and give you our hot takes. But first, let's talk about where we write. I freelance at a number of publications, including Did They Like It, Theaterly, American Theater. You can follow me at Juan Michael II for the second on Twitter.
I'm Christian Lewis. I also freelance all over the place, including Did They Like It, Theater Mania, Theaterly, American Theater Magazine. All of my writing can be found on my Twitter, at CLewisReviews.
Hi, I'm Vidhatri, and I also write all over the place, but mostly on film and documentaries. But when I'm writing about theater, it's usually for Did They Like It. And you can have access to all my writing on my Twitter, which is at Vidhatri, my first name.
Now let's jump into our show today, Birthday Candles. Christian, I'm really excited about this because you are a star baker, of course, but first, a quick synopsis. Emmy Award winner Deborah Messing from Will and Grace comes home to Broadway in the poignant and funny new hit play about the extraordinary moments that make up one woman's ordinary life. Messing leads a remarkable cast as Ernestine Ashworth, who spends her 17th birthday agonizing over her insignificance in the universe. Soon enough, it's her 18th birthday, even sooner her 41st, her 70th, her 101st. Five generations, an infinity of dreams, and one cake, baked over a century, this true gift of a play, according to Variety, will take you through the highlights and heartbreaks of 90 years in 90 minutes. As the Daily News says, Messing is extraordinarily moving. It's truly a must-see show. I know that Chris Jones wrote that, and I was sitting behind him at the show where he was bawling next to his son, and it was really touching. First thoughts, I'm curious, what did you think? I want to hear from you, Vidhatri.
It's one of those, it's very much like TV. It draws you in. Like, you just want to see what happens, and I really like the pacing. I know it's 100 years fit within, like, a very short play. I mean, relatively short, given like the long run times this season on the Broadway. But, you know, it was very engrossing. I was and the set was, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that. The set was so beautifully designed. And so it really sucks you in. But then later, when you sit back and think about it, I was just like, it was fun. But, you know, that's about it. I don't think it was particularly profound.
I'll get into the baking, but it's funny for me even to like, hear the like very crazy pull quotes from Chris Jones and others and to hear people crying, because I was sitting there like not affected by this play at all. I found it hollow, cheesy. I wrote a review of it for Theater Mania, and I think I called it like Our Town fan fiction. Was definitely like not, I'm not very into this play, and my biggest, well, I have several critiques, including I was not a fan of Deborah Messing's pretty overacted performance. But as a star baker, my biggest issue is the central birthday cake of this production. The whole point is we're supposed to watch Deborah Messing bake a single cake over 90 years and 90 minutes. And I don't know who trained her, but fire that baking consultant and get another person, because she literally couldn't even like measure flour properly, let alone like mix anything. And then the cake she makes is a boring one layer, 8-inch round birthday cake that she throws out. It's not decorated. Nobody eats it. It was the cake part of this was so disappointing. And we, as critics, we get the script, and there's an entire like page-long note in the script about how important the baking on stage is. And I was like, did the director and everyone just completely ignore this? Because in this production, the baking is not that important. But I will end my baking-related rant there so we can move on.
No, I said this. I came out of the theater and I said this to my friend, that if I were the playwright, I would definitely make that woman sit and eat a slice of cake after, like, she spent 100 years baking it.
It would have been more compelling than throwing it out undecorated. Also, the play is called Birthday Candles, and they never put damn candles on the cake.
Yeah. But also, my South Asian childhood, you know, rung through my head with my mom's words saying, don't waste food. What are you doing? Don't waste food.
You know, I think it's the show did not take the cake, and more than that, it didn't offer us any. It was very sweet. I was moved by the people around me who were crying, and what it reminded me of was being in Colorado, where I worked for a year, with people who are not running around like we are in New York City all the time. And so in my mind, I thought, are tourists who come here to see this pleased with seeing a slice of their life? Does this actually fulfill them? Or is this just talking back to them what they think about themselves? And this isn't to say that people in other parts of the country are simpler, but I do think that there was something a bit trite about this. And that didn't bother me because I didn't think that the play was reaching for much. I know that the playwright, Noah Hadel, he'd actually suffered a bit of mental unwellness and had gone home and spent time with his family who took care of him. And so I kept thinking, maybe this is a tribute to them, a tribute to the people who nurtured him, even though it's supposed to be about this caretaker who we learn very little about. So that's a bit of a problem for me, that this woman who's on stage the entire show ends up being an unknown and in the hands of Messing, almost a sort of caricature of what an aging woman is. What did we think about the production itself, the design, the costumes, the lighting?
But as we mentioned, I think the set design is certainly like pretty beautifully done. It's a very realistic rendered like kitchen. Above it, it has like floating props that are all important in this woman's life. And I found that nice. I liked the lighting design. Costumes were pretty innocuous, but the sound design, in my opinion, is just like unforgivable. And there's a moment when characters die and there's like this wind chime noise, and it's like the cheesiest thing ever. And I'm gonna be haunted by that wind chime noise for a while. I don't know about you, but Autry.
About the sound, there's that little gong that goes on, you know, with every year passing. I mean, by the 10th time, I was like, I get it. You know, I was just like, do it the first 5 times. Trust your audience. They'll know after that, right? But that gong, like Christian and the wind chime, it's the gong in me.
One thing about that is when you mentioned the cake coming out, I remember smelling it and having this moment of like, oh, and now we're going to get the cake. And then, like you said, it's just thrown away. And I was very impressed that the kitchen worked, that it was a functional kitchen. But I didn't feel like there was much about it that was integrated into their daily lives. It seemed to be almost like a TV show thing that's there, but that doesn't really affect everyone, regardless of how beautiful it is. I'm wondering, would you all have preferred to have seen them using the set more?
I actually, you know, one thing I thought about, like, this is 100 years of a woman's life, and all we see is her kitchen, you know, and then she talks about her travels for a bit with her son. She's sharing the photo album. And I wish we saw a little more beyond the kitchen. I mean, I was very impressed that it's a working kitchen. I love a good oven as much as the next Christian. I do think I wish I had seen more of her world outside of the kitchen, because we hear so much about it.
Yeah, I'm also convinced that there's some theater magic happening with that oven, because that cake that came out of the oven is not the cake that Deborah Messing mixed together. It's not. It's just not. But it did smell nice, so I'll give you that.
Were there any particular performances that stood out to you? I'm going to make one comment that I was particularly annoyed with the sudden old lady voice that Deborah Messing started to put on as she got older. And that when it was happening, I thought, is she really doing this? And I hate to trash on anyone. And I'm just going to come out and say that I think she was miscast. And I wish that Jane Houdyshell had been in the part, because the part can be ageless, which is a note in the script. And I think that Jane Houdyshell, who is phenomenal, and Coraline, and who has seen both sides of life, would have brought something true to this that would have elevated the text and the entire experience.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked Ernestine's friend Kenneth, played by Enrico Colantoni. I hope I'm saying that right. He's adorable. And like, you know, he's the kind of, you know, as a straight woman, I'm just like, oh, I wish I met someone like that when I was 17. I mean, I don't, I'd probably curse my luck. But you know, one thing that really did not sit well with me is Matt, Ernestine's husband, played by John Earl Jelks. And he's fantastic throughout the play. But there is that bit where he like, play acts in a way that we're supposed to assume he's had a stroke or something. And it's just not nice the way he does it. It's like, you know, it's like one of those things we used to do in like when we were kids in middle school, like middle school bullies used to do to make fun of someone who walks a little different, who talks a little different, or like, you know, just makes fun of someone with a lisp, you know, like the lowest hanging fruit kind of acting. I really did not appreciate that. And I think the play could have gone on very well without those few seconds of him acting like that.
Yeah, I was really put off by the fact that both a lot of the jokes about like the daughter-in-law that's like very anxious and like maybe neuroatypical, and then each of the other actors had a moment where they were like dramatically dying of some like very tragic Dickens melodramatic thing on stage, and I was just like, don't know why they had to do that. It felt kind of ableist in its melodrama and its comedy, and did not like that. And one, Michael, I really agree. I was like really shocked when I read that note in the script that said that like any actress of any age can play Ernestine, and there's actually an iteration of the show where she doesn't perform age at all. Would have loved to see that. Also, this will come up in a later episode probably, but also on this season we have Mary Louise Parker performing a lot of ages and showing how subtly that can be done. So I think to your point of Deborah Messing was probably just not the actress for this role.
Christian, you brought up a term that I don't know everyone is familiar with, ableist. Could you actually speak to that? Because it's so important for everyone to be aware of this.
Yeah, thank you for stopping me to define that for everyone. Ableism is a prejudice, stigma against disabled people, very akin to like a homophobia or a racism of people discriminating against for various reasons. And so when I say that a play is ableist, I'm saying that it's like taking a bad view and misappropriating and being inconsiderate towards actual disabled people by treating disability in this show to be something to be laughed at or to cry at.
I wouldn't say that our director, Vivian Binesh, was doing this purposefully, but at this level, one has to think about all the angles about how this is received, particularly by the communities who are affected by that representation. And a lot of times I know people who aren't in the theater who would say, well, how else were they supposed to do it? And they sort of think that we as critics are giving people a hard time. And I would say that this was a solution. Instead of play acting it, just acknowledge it and speak to the person. When these transformations occur, they occur within seconds. And the nuance that we all know that goes into someone acquiring dementia or suicide ideation or a stroke, it happens over the course of years. It's not this sort of jarring thing, which becomes almost mean to observe. And I don't think it was necessary, I think is what we are all saying, to have indicated that. They could have just done the text and then let it be, and the audience would have understood and would have actually felt grateful, especially those of us who have seen that occur to people in our families, to have not been, I'm not going to say traumatized, but it was hurtful. It was definitely hurtful.
Yeah, it felt like by doing it that quick, it was like insensitive.
Where do you think that this show would play well? Like, let's say that Broadway is not the place for it.
At the time, my take, which I want to say with as much like love and kindness as possible, is that this is a really great play for a high school to do. It has themes that people are going to love in a high school audience. It has some nice acting challenges for high schoolers. You can cast it in a couple different ways, because here it was cast where the ensemble was all like triple casted, but you could just have everyone play their one character if you needed a bigger cast for a high school. But also, really, based on Badawtry and Montmichael, you're talking about the kitchen. I'd love to see this, like, maybe, like, in the round at a very small off-Broadway theater where we can, like, really see that baking happening. Like, that might be very cool and a very hyper-realistic or even site-specific thing. Like, in a kitchen, give us a full, real, working kitchen that we can see close up.
Yeah, I'm just really glad and fortunate that three absolute sugar fiends are discussing this play. But I agree with Christian that I also think because this play explores, like, you know, themes of feminism, even like feminist thought, family, because it does it in a very broad strokes kind of manner. We've talked about how it's not very nuanced. So I do think, you know, it's a very good play for young women to watch, to think, you know, to get those ideas, you know, when we first start reading Virginia Woolf, you know, that age, you know, where you like, your kitchen is not your world, there's a world that lies behind it, you know, that kind of thing. So I would definitely like to see how a young audience of women would react to this play. Also, both Christian and I have been talking about the sets, and I just wanted to name the person behind it, Christine Jones, so just shout out.
About the stars above that you all mentioned, that felt like, I love that those objects weren't in the daily business of what was going on stage, because it's very tight, it goes by very quickly. And it felt like, oh, these are the things that make up a person's life that sort of revolve around them. And that felt really beautiful and very well realized. I think something about the feminism within this play, the fact that I mentioned earlier that we don't really get Ernestine's voice or perspective, that she's essentially a servant for other people. And there is a moment where she starts to travel and live for herself and start her own business, but it seems to actually occur within only a few gongs or a few years or and therefore a few minutes. And then she's back to serving people. And for those who don't, when we mentioned that the show is triple cast, the actors who play her family members go from being maybe a lover to a child to a grandchild to a neighbor later on. And so you see things being passed on down through the lineage. And while that is really profound and beautiful to observe, because there was nothing grounding it that made you think, well, why are we coming back to this particular woman, aside from the fact that that's the conceit of the play? I started to think, well, I'd rather go follow those other people. I don't really care about this woman anymore. And I'm curious if you all found the central performance lacking as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, and I brought up Virginia Woolf for a reason. It's you know, the feminism is very white first wave. You know, this whole idea of a caregiver, but with a little ambition, but enough to not, like, ruffle feathers, you know. Vote, you know, let's find a way to vote, but, like, let's not talk about what's happening at home. You know, that's what I mean by, you know, the feminism in this is very first wave, and which is why I brought in Virginia Woolf and why I think this would resonate with younger women who need that introduction into feminist thought and female agency. But once you've worked past that, you've grown past that, I think this film, I keep saying film because that's my daily bread, but this plays feminism is a little outdated, which is why I think it doesn't, it kind of like sits a little wonky with the times.
I was even surprised to hear anyone talk about the feminism of the play, because I was like, oh, she mentions wanting to be like Queen Lear in a play. Like, is that what we're like, is that our bar now for what counts as feminism? Because, like, it's a really low bar for me. I don't know if I necessarily find the character very underwritten. I think I was just so kind of like put off by Deborah Messing's performance, where when she was a teenager, she was like hand on hips, pouty, like, I want to be Queen Lear. And then by the time she was an old lady, she was like bent over and like doing this old lady voice. And I was like, oh boy. But like, that's why, like, before I can even judge if that character is underwritten, I just would love to like see someone else do it, because I think maybe someone else could make a lot of that part.
But on the other hand, I would love for Deborah Messing to play Lucille Ball, because when she cries, I'm like, that's I Love Lucy. You know, I shouldn't be thinking that way, but I did. And I was like, that's a missed opportunity. Somebody should cast her as Lucille Ball.
Move over, Nicole Kidman.
Agree.
I love this. Well, final thoughts.
I don't think I would recommend people to go see Birthday Candles, but if you're a tearjerker kind of person and you want to have a little tearjerker of a play, go see it. And I hope that this play has some kind of future in high schools and community theaters, in other castings and other imaginings. I don't think this version is definitely not for me, but I don't think the play is useless in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Christian. I do think, you know, if you want to watch it, it is a good play in the sense of its pacing, its production design. We've talked about it. So, you know, if that's your thing, then yeah, sure, go ahead and watch it. Watch it with your mom and grandmom, perhaps. Like, people next to me were crying. So, I mean, if that's your shtick, then maybe you should watch it.
Sumptuous production, saccharine center, makes people cry. If that's your jam, if you're coming from out of town and you want to feel something, then I think that this play might be for you. And I know that not everyone is looking for War and Peace. And so I would actually suggest it to people who maybe find Les Mis to be a little too complicated for them. And I say that lovingly.
Yeah, and it's Mother's Day. So this is I think it's a nice Mother's Day play.
Absolutely. Not too challenging, not going to fight with each other, going to say, see, that's you.
Go have some mimosas with your mom after. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Critics Table podcast. We would like to thank Jose Solis and the BIPOC Critics Lab team who have generously partnered with us on this project. You can find out more about the BIPOC Critics Lab at BIPOCCriticsLab.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to this podcast so that you never miss a review, and learn more about our critics at bpn.fm/critics table. The views or opinions expressed by the critics in this episode are solely their own and do not necessarily represent views or opinions of the Broadway Podcast Network. See you next time.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the SUFS. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, SUFS celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. SUFS has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.